For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. The Ten Commandments monument at the state capitol has been removed and shipped to the headquarters for conservative think tank Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs. Ryan, this happened in the dead of night. Was this a good thing?
No, absolutely it was. You know, the monument itself has proved divisive enough, and so the likelihood of protest, of some sort of histrionics that would have taken place had the monument been removed at some scheduled date and time during the middle of the day, would have been much more likely than just going in at some unannounced time and making the removal at the middle of the night like they did the other night. So, you know, we're pleased with the way that the state government handled the removal of the monument to ensure that it was at least in the least divisive way possible. You know, there's still a lot of questions that revolve around the monument. This is a temporary location at OCPA. There are questions about ownership. Apparently, the monument maker has not been paid. And so we've resolved the constitutional issues for the most part, which say that Oklahomans, regardless of how they believe or whether they choose to believe at all, are equal whenever they go to their state government, their seat of state government. And the state government has no business in telling people of Oklahoma how to believe. But now we're in this custody battle, and Ten Commandments litigation is probably not over. Johnston County officials, about 12 hours before the removal of the monument from the state capitol, put their own monument up in front of their courthouse in Johnston County. So we're going to continue to see this. This is an issue that's been with us for as long as the republic has existed, and it's not going to go away tomorrow.
Neva.
Well, I think what's interesting is that in moving forward, Governor Fallon made it very clear a day after the monument was moved that she really wants lawmakers to place a measure on the 2016 ballot to reword, revise the wording in the Oklahoma Constitution that has brought about this prohibition and change and removing the monument from state property. So I think, as we've talked about in recent weeks, this was anticipated. I think she stepped right out front and is taking a very forceful leadership role. And I think, frankly, we would expect that, given the makeup of the current legislature, that there will be a lot of support for this moving forward very quickly in the legislative session. So I think the battle and clash of ideas on this, of those who oppose the idea of a monument being on state property versus many, and myself included, who believe that this is an action that was unwarranted, that privately funded tributes like this to historical events is not a taxpayer-funded endorsement of any religion. And I think that you can point to other states. So we've looked at Texas before, which has a monument almost identical to the one that was removed in front of their state capitol. So there's clearly strong differences of opinion on this, and I think now it may move to a different venue and be one that the citizens of Oklahoma ultimately will get to have their say on next year, very possibly.
There's talk about, you mentioned about it, we don't know who owns the rights. The person who built it says, or the second one, built the second one, says he hasn't gotten paid yet. Now the OCPA is going to be in charge of upkeep, and we're talking about $10,000 every time this thing gets damaged. You know, isn't this thing a little bit more expensive than maybe we should be dealing
with? It's a really cheap political ad. I mean, as far as political ads go, this is a very cheap one. And I think that what we're seeing is more politics here. And it's easy to play politics because, and it's essentially free for the state. The governor and the legislature will get to step out on this, and they'll continue to use religion as a political weapon to divide Oklahomans at the ballot box in hopes of winning re-election instead of focusing on the $1 billion shortfall that they're going to have during this legislative session.
I don't think you can say divide the people. I think the people have an opportunity to make a choice, and there are clearly people on both sides of this issue, and I think what this really extends out to is another opportunity for the voters to have a say in what they want in the state constitution and whether they want this particular issue specifically addressed.
There are some things, though, that our constitution places beyond the reach of majorities, and and religion is one of those. And so the idea that the majority would weigh in, of course they would. You know, the majority of Oklahomans are
But can't they weigh in
on
the notion that it is a historical event and really it deals with something far beyond just the idea that it is religion per se? And I think that's one of the great debates in this mix.
Well, and our plaintiffs in this case would argue that by doing that, that you're sullying their deeply held religious beliefs, that these are a sacred part of their their belief system.
And in Texas in 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the Ten Commandments monument in front of their state capitol was in fact okay. So,
and Justice Breyer in that same case said that a contemporary effort, because this case has been out there for 50 years, that he said that a contemporary effort would likely be unsuccessful. So we may have an opportunity to take this before a federal court and challenge the First Amendment issues. But I think a challenge to the state constitution ultimately succeeded. Amending the state constitution, I think, would be a big mistake.
A breaking story in yesterday's Oklahoman shows Department of Corrections officials used the wrong drugs to kill Charles Warner back in January. Apparently, they used potassium acetate instead of potassium chloride to stop his heart. Neva, is this yet another black eye for Oklahoma's execution process?
It's the exact issue that we're still dealing with, is which of these protocols is proper, which if it was in fact one that was used on January 15th that was in violation of the protocol, then it certainly raises questions on the one that has been stopped currently. And I think the issue here is Attorney General Scott Pruitt has been very direct in saying when he launched this investigation that not only do they need a complete and full investigation of what's taken place previously, as well as what's currently at question. And I think ultimately we've got to get the issue resolved once and for all on these protocols. I mean, on the drugs that are going to be in this, quote, cocktail that are going to be used for lethal injections. It's unfortunate that, there's still so many questions swirling around this. I mean, first of all, these drugs are delivered on the day of the execution, and you would think, one would think, I mean, just on the surface, that whoever was charged with the task and responsibility of getting the proper drugs to the penitentiary to be used would in fact be the correct one. So there are a lot of issues here, like we talked about last week, and those are kind of above and beyond whether or not the death penalty should be used, and whether or not the issue of the stay, should it be indefinite, or what happens in that particular instance, who knows?
Ryan, one of the issues, isn't it transparency, that we're still hiding behind these curtains and we don't have any openness about the drugs, about anything that's going on?
Absolutely. Neva's absolutely correct. There are a lot of unanswered questions swirling around. And regardless of where Oklahomans fall on the issue of the death penalty, and I know that there's a division among Oklahomans on this, and people have very adamant beliefs on both sides. But I think that we should all agree that whenever the state's exercising its ultimate authority to put somebody to death, that we shouldn't have these many unanswered questions. And it's a direct result of the state's insistence on secrecy, the lack of transparency, and the lack of independent oversight. So when you put all of those things together, not only do we have unanswered questions, it invites the kind of error that we're looking at right now. Because there's really no check that's occurring except for these last-minute checks. And in Mr. Warner's case, no check that showed up because they actually executed him with the wrong drug. They can argue that it's interchangeable all day long, but the protocol was violated, and their own internal protocol was violated here.
And I think what we also are seeing, though, and I think we should give credit to the fact that we do have the Attorney General, we do have the governor, who have stepped up and said, look, we want a full vetting of this process, and we want to investigate, we want to see what the facts are, and we want to lay them all out for public scrutiny and to make that information fully transparent. So at least we don't have a situation where we have anyone trying to stonewall or anyone trying to say that, yes, there are problems here, yes, there are questions that have to be resolved and all of this has to be properly vetted and accounted for. And I do think that they should be given credit for that, as opposed to the black eye that we get continually, not only in headlines in Oklahoma, but across the nation for not being able to fully get this under control and resolved.
I hope one of the recommendations that comes out of this is that we abandon this insistence on secrecy, because even if we go back to Mr. Warner, they used the wrong drug and the state's saying, well, it worked. There are folks saying, well, it worked. We really don't know if it worked. We use a paralytic agent, which in and of itself serves no other purpose than to mask any sort of signs of struggle or pain during the execution process itself. So we can say it worked. Well, we don't know. And the FDA certainly wouldn't approve a drug based upon one instance of it working in its application. So you know, if we can, again, I agree the attorney general and the governor are currently doing the right thing in investigating this, making sure everything's on the table. But I think moving forward, any recommendations that happen have to insist on more transparency and more independent oversight with all executions.
An appeals court overturns the blackmail conviction of Sooner Tea Party leader Al Gearhart. Now, Gearhart had been convicted for sending emails to a state senator and intended to intimidate him on a piece of legislation. Ryan, the ACLU is actually in support of this decision by the appellate court.
Yeah, our legal director, Brady Henderson, did some of the early work during that trial, during the district court hearing on this case. This is a huge decision. It's a huge win for the First Amendment and for free speech, and in particular, political speech. You know, we talk about constitutional protections for speech. Well, political speech, if we're going to put it up on a pedestal, that's the one that gets up on the pedestal. You know, we have to guarantee that all of us can participate in our democracy by expressing our opinions, and sometimes saying that there will be consequences, electoral consequences, for people who don't do what you want them to do. Now, that doesn't mean that people always do it in the most polite manner. And sometimes, you know, you can look at what Mr. Gearhart said and say that what he did amounted to crass and inappropriate language. And I think that a lot of people would agree with that. But being impolite doesn't mean that it's unlawful. And so people of Oklahoma, I think, can rest easy now knowing that whether it's as the court said, a corporate lobbyist who is saying, we want you to vote this way in a committee hearing, and if you don't, you know, there's an implication that you're not going to get our support during the next reelection campaign, or Mr. Gearhart saying that there's going to be some sort of consequences that don't amount to a true threat, that speech is protected. It's part of our political process. It's not always neat and clean. Sometimes it's messy, but it's protected.
Neva.
Well, I mean, this was a 3-2 decision, and it was, I think it was a close decision for a reason. We had a real, a real conflict here in the debate between the freedom of speech and protection of and blackmail. I mean, and that was really the assertion of the prosecutors in this case. If we remember, I mean, we had emails from Al Gearhart that basically told this senator, you get that bill heard or you'll regret doing it, went on to say this is a promise, and the inference and the clear suggestion is that that the family was also going to be part of what was going to not only be their backgrounds dug into, but that they were going to be affected by this as well. And so I think what it has is a very chilling effect on folks that are in public life, in public office, and those thinking about running. When you have this unbridled, I mean, it's beyond just crass or vicious rhetoric, and there's still plenty of that going on, and we don't see the end of it anytime coming. But there is that fine line, and I think that was what was really having to be weighted, just like the jury when they sat, heard this information, and made their decision that he was in fact guilty, and guilty making more of a, it appeared, a statement, because they had the opportunity to have a jail time. It was a $1,000 fine only, but the appeals process has come back and made this rendering, and I do think we'll see, unfortunately, in all likelihood, other instances like this come about, because we have some folks that I think it goes beyond the pale what is happening in some of the political political arena, and that divide between true political free speech and what becomes absolute bribery, absolute blackmail, absolute extortion. I mean, all of the things that do go beyond free speech.
This Tuesday, the Oklahoma City Council is voting on an ordinance banning everyone from standing on medians. The measure designed to stop panhandling is now so broad it would ban firefighters from taking part in the Fill the Boot campaign for the Muscular Dystrophy Association and journalists from reporting on accidents and weather events. Neva, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, and it also, I think, would preclude political candidates from being able to stand and wave their sign on election day. So there are all kinds of implications here. And this is one where I think Ryan and I can agree. I think they've gone way beyond in thinking, in their thought process on this, what to the extent that they've come up with this ordinance. It's an overreach. It's unnecessary, frankly, as many have said, including some of the council members in this discussion. There already are laws on the books that that deal with this issue. So the stretch to say that that there have been these deaths and all of these statistics that they're trying to throw out there to make their argument, I think, are weak. And I think the only thing that was probably, from my point of view, injected into the conversation that may need some outside or special attention is when you have a school district, a school superintendent like the Millwood superintendent saying that there was concern about their children and those walking in the school area and having some concerns about these panhandlers in that area. But it would seem to me that there could be a way to address that without having to absolutely go with this all-out overreach that this ordinance, in my view, has done.
And interesting in that situation, then one of the counselors actually said that if you took the panhandler and take them out of the median and put them on the sidewalk, you haven't changed that.
That's so exactly
right.
Right.
You haven't. Millwood at all.
Well, and if you're gonna go and try to protect these students that are walking to and from school, there are probably some narrowly tailored solutions that you can use to do that that would meet constitutional scrutiny. And frankly, if that's our goal, there are probably already laws on the books that, if enforced appropriately, could step in and doesn't require this new conversation and this new contemplation of a new city ordinance. I mean, I can recall just within the last couple of years standing in a median on Lincoln Boulevard for a press conference, and we held a press conference in the median of Lincoln Boulevard primarily because we were talking about the state Republican parties. I think that there was some anti-Muslim rhetoric, and they wouldn't let us have
We may need to make an exception here. Let me check this out.
Well, see, that's just it. If it's overly broad, it's unconstitutional. If you start to carve out exceptions,
exactly.
Then it's also unconstitutional.
Absolutely.
You've got journalists, you've got the Homeless Alliance. This would essentially put an end to the Curbside Chronicle, which has been an incredibly important tool in combating homelessness in the state of Oklahoma, or in Oklahoma City in particular. And whether the counselors are doing this or not, intentionally or not, and I don't think that they are. I really don't think that they are. This is just one more mark that could criminalize and punish poverty. The last thing that we need to do is to make it possible in any other way for a person that's homeless to end up in the Oklahoma County Jail.
Because they can't pay a $500 fine.
Yep.
$500 fine.
If they're already panhandling, they probably can't afford to pay for a ticket or a fine.
And the debate on whether or not they're homeless or on the verge of being homeless, the result is the same. And a $500 fine, if imposed, is going to pretty well move them to the category.
You're
going
to go to the county jail. Yeah. And the county jail, the last thing the county jail needs is more people in it.
We all know that prisons are overcrowded as it is.
So, it's something that I think creates more problems than it solves. It's a classic First Amendment issue. ACLU affiliates around the country have been involved in these panhandling ordinance fights. And the courts at the federal level are on our side here. And so I think that it would be a wise move for the city council to step back, reject this proposal and not hear it at all next Tuesday, and then really begin to think about what are the actual problems that we're trying to face and what are some more nuanced ways to do that, and are there existing laws that allow us to take care of that problem?
I want to talk about Real ID. It's getting a lot of attention in the news right now. According to a press release from the governor earlier this week, Oklahoma's extension to comply with the 2005 law expires tomorrow. The measure requires people to have better identification than our state provides. Some have said when it takes full effect, Oklahomans might need to find different IDs to enter military bases or even board a plane. Ryan, should we be concerned?
The federal government has been threatening to do this for a very long time now. And every time they do, they push the deadline back. Because especially whenever it comes to being able to get on an airplane, the impact that would have on the United States economy, because we're not just talking about states like Oklahoma, we're talking about states with enormous populations like New York that aren't in compliance right now. And you would have the entire state of New York and their population not being able to get on planes to fly. That date now is in 2016. I imagine that it's going to continue to get pushed back. We may be in an instance where Oklahomans, to get into federal buildings or anything like that, we've got to pass a security checkpoint, have to have a passport. But it's ridiculous that the federal government is essentially, now I'm going to sound like Scott Pruitt here, the Attorney General, the federal government bullying states into compliance here and saying that if you do not basically submit your IDs to a scenario where we're going to create a national database and you've got to have a national ID card to participate in any number of activities, and the states have asserted, we don't want to do that, To me, I think that this is overly punitive for a benefit that just really doesn't pan out. So long-term flights, I don't think that that's ever going to come to fruition. That's always going to get pushed back. I'm pretty confident in that. Federal buildings, military installations, maybe a different question.
Looking into the history of this was very interesting because, of course, it was passed by a Republican U.S. House and Senate and signed by a Republican president. But it has had bipartisan opposition from the left and the right. Senator Constance Johnson and Republican
Charles
Key were the co-authors this fight.
Right.
I mean, strange bedfellows in politics, but certainly it has been a bipartisan opposition.
It's something I changed my mind on. You know, Representative Wesselhoff was one of the carried the bill in the Oklahoma House to exempt the state of Oklahoma from compliance, and I voted against that. And over the years, I've reconsidered my position on that. I have changed my position. You know, a big thing.
Well,
in
and
Oklahoma
let's remember,
politics,
it was in response to 9/11.
Right.
I mean, this whole thing came out of something that, when we look back, it was predictable that many of these things would rise out of that particular event in our country. But you know, when you look at it just strictly, as you said, from the money standpoint, I think the figure that has been tossed around in terms of how much it will take to implement in all 50 states is $11 billion. I mean, the price tag that I've heard in Oklahoma, I believe, is something like $8 million, but then there's another
$23 million for five years.
So, I mean, you're talking, you know, again, I mean, all of these folks that are having to implement, talk about this, they're looking at the price tag attached to it, and are there other ways to deal with fake IDs, the terrorist threat, the fact that we do need to have, we do need to have things in place to be able to deal with those issues, but it's that struggle between personal information and then the overreach or the intrusion and the bureaucratic process. And I think at the end of the day, you're right. I mean, I think it has been a process where people have kind of been all over the board on it, because as each new revelation comes out, it alters, you know, our view, I think, in terms of the good and the bad. And I think you're right, Ryan. I mean, it's a slippery slope. Certainly, if we had to have every Tinker employee next month or next year have to have a passport to be able to get to work on the base, I mean, that has implications. I think it's only one out of three Oklahomans currently have a passport.
That's right.
So it's an interesting question with a lot of ramifications. And I think right now what we probably see is that we're going to continue to kick the can a little while down the road.
This also would crack down a little bit on illegal immigration. Do you think there's conservatives who might say that
every one of these issues that we kind of throw in the mix on top of another issue, it compounds the not only the debate, but it makes it even more difficult to come up with a solution.
Yeah.
It really does.
Well, I think it's for most Oklahomans, and one of the reasons that I think that we're one of the states that's been pushing back against this is that when you weigh the security benefit that would be realized out of a real ID, national ID program versus the loss of privacy rights that we would give up by complying with this and putting all of Oklahomans into a national database of IDs.
Yeah, Oklahomans don't like that.
We don't like that. And so, the security benefits, I think, just don't exist. I mean, you're right. Right in the wake of 9/11, Oklahoma's all Americans were willing to give up a little bit of their individual liberties for the promise of an increased security for our nation and for them individually. But as we are further and further away from that, and we begin to think about this thing as a society, about what are we willing to give up or increased security? Well, we could have a heck of a lot more security as a nation, but we'd have a lot less personal liberty. And so that balance is beginning to realign itself. And I think real ID is just one of the areas we see it to play out.
And there's still questions about whether the security would even be there in the first
place. Yeah. And I don't think it would be.
Yeah. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.